This is episode 2C of Free as in Freedom for Tuesday, June 19th, 2012. Hi, I'm Karen Failer.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free as in Freedom.
And we have the final installment in the FOSDEM 2012 Policy and Legal Track Talks.
Excellent. I'm glad we broke it up a little bit so that we had some other regular episodes in between.
Well, we're waiting for a license on this one was the main issue. And we now have a license. Oh, no, wait. We have one more talk.
Oh, do we?
I forgot. We do have a recording of Mike Linksfair's talk. Which we can use at a later date. So this is, in fact,
okay.
Not.
At another talk where the speaker was going to see if they could edit the talk. So there could be two, but I think there's only one.
No, there's only one, I think. There's two more. One is going to be in this episode, and one's going to be in the next episode. This episode, we have the first talk of the day.
Yep. I would recommend in this one taking a look at the slides if you're not walking or driving or doing anything
right.
else
so
at
this
the same
is,
time.
This was the opening talk by Philippe Laurent regarding various different, I guess, just discussing different case law that appeared in European courts for open source and free software.
Yeah, I think it's a good overview and summary of the state of play in the EU.
The state of play?
State of play.
He wasn't talking about any sort of playing. I'm not sure what you mean.
It's a common expression.
I was about to kill the web browser.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
I was trying to kill the web browser because it was taking up too much CPU time because Zool Runner always takes up all the CPU time, and then the recording doesn't have enough CPU time. And then I realized if I killed the web browser, I'd also kill the thing we're looking at to talk about what talk we have, and that wouldn't work.
I'm not looking at that.
Well, I was looking at that.
Because I have my slides up.
Oh, okay. Well, so I think probably you'll want to listen to this talk with the slides. I think that's basically correct.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of information on the slides about the cases.
Yeah. And actually, I find the slides to be useful on their own as well.
So I guess we'll listen now to Philippe's talk, and then we'll discuss it later. And then some future episode, we'll have Mike Linksfair's talk.
Perfect. Enjoy.
Well, of course, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers and the committee to invite me to make a presentation, a quick presentation on the case law, the European case law, involving free open source, but also open content licenses. And as I said to Tom, it's a pleasure for me to be the first speaker to the first legal dev room in my hometown, Brussels. So thank you very much for this great opportunity. So we're going to start dialectic. First of all, I would like to explain why I put in my title open source and free software, but also open content. It's because I think it's interesting to broaden the scope, because here in Europe, and more particularly in Belgium, we reached some great results with the implementation and the enforcement of open content licenses, and more particularly Creative Commons licenses. And I think that with that kind of result that we reached here in Belgium, it could be very interesting to make some links in order to strengthen the implementation and the enforcement of software licenses such as GPL, for instance. Of course, I will not be rude and explain what's the difference between the four freedoms of FSF, the FSF definition, and the 10 criteria of the OSI. I will not explain either what Creative Commons licenses. I suppose that everybody knows what it is exactly, so I will not spend much time on that slide. So, analyzing the European case law, but basically it could be done in different ways. And doing it in 20 minutes, it's very challenging. So I had to make choices and try to create a thread between the cases in order to, well, just explain my point of view on how I analyze it. So basically there are several big questions and important questions. The first question was, of course, are the licenses valid? Are they acknowledged by courts and tribunals? Are they valid or acknowledged as a whole? And we can start going into details and analyze each and every clause of the license and analyze what the courts and tribunals think about specific clauses. In 20 minutes, it's quite impossible to do that. Another way to go through the case law, and that's the kind of thing that I will try to do, is basically asking oneself, what can I ask to a judge? What can I request? When there is an infringement, which are the remedies that I could ask a judge to grant me? And basically, it's possible, I think, to divide the remedies in three categories. The first one is to make the infringement stop, saying to the infringer, you didn't respect the license, now you have to stop. A stop order. In other words, it's a cease and desist action. And the main aim is to make the infringer stop. And usually, at least in civil law jurisdictions, there are specific procedures to reach that aim. Another aim could be an indemnification, meaning there has been a copyright infringement, so I've suffered a damage, and this damage should be indemnified in some way. So that would be a second step. First you stop, then you indemnify me. And here I have to make it clear. When I say pay, I do not include in that category the fact of asking an infringer to pay back the lawyer's fees or the procedural costs. It goes more than that. It's really pay an amount of money because you infringed my copyright. And the last category that we could also identify is whether it's possible to go to a court and say, this infringer accepted my license, a GPL for instance, he therefore accepted the copyleft clause, he created a derivative work, and then I asked the judge, please make him release his derivative work under the GPL. That's the third category. I've put it on my slide because I think it's interesting just to evoke this idea. But you will see that you will never see the red box again on any on my other slides, because in the case law right now in Europe, we didn't reach so far and we never tried to go that far, forcing somebody to release a derivative work under a GPL, for instance. So my analysis, we reach the conclusion that a stop order is quite easily obtained, and maybe a Belgian particularity is that we already reached a second level, namely making somebody pay just because he breached an open content license. Okay, so this is my case list. I try to be as exhaustive as possible. So, of course, it's really challenging to present all these cases. I forced myself to create one slide per case, which was quite complicated, and it has had a direct influence on the font size. But such a man it is, it's going to be readable, and I think that we're going to publish these slides later on the website. I'm going to make a selection in my presentation, because I've got already 10 minutes left, so I'm going to be very quick and try to focus only on my threat, namely stop order, making people pay, and maybe forcing to comply, but I said already that the case law didn't reach that point. Okay, so first part, free and open source software. Second part, open content licenses. And in my first part, it can also be divided in two type of cases. the German cases, which all involve Mr. Howard Welt, who is present here. So I'm not gonna go into details because he knows the details much better than I know them. And another thing is that all the case law is in German. I do not read German, so I just based my presentation on the English translations.
That are all GPL cases.
They are all GPL cases. Yes. And a second subpart, the French case law. And what is very interesting to see is that Germany is really about compliance, except the last one. So basically, infringer who does not respect the license and they are sued by the copyright owners. And in France, it's always about very, very messy contractual situations. So it's also involving a lot of people doing weird stuff and infringing copyrights indirectly or whatever, but there are cases much more about contracts than really infringing a license or enforcing a license. Okay, so of course the first German case, Netfilter versus Sitecom, was a groundbreaking decision, very important one. Actually, retrospectively, it was quite a clear-cut case of infringement. So we had somebody, well, Mr. Welt, who participated in the creation of a work, Netfilter, which was part of the Linux kernel. So basically, he was a person who could actually enforce the GPL on the Linux kernel. And we have a wireless hardware producer, Sitecom, who used the work of Mr. Welt and installed Linux as a firmware on the hardware. And the firmware was downloadable and it contained, well, Mr. Welt's work, Netfilter IP tables. And the problem was that the GPL was not respected at all. No reference to the fact that the firmware contained a GPL code. No reference to the license, no source code available, nothing. So the authors, copyright owners, brought the case before court and asked for a preliminary injunction. And the German court reacted quite well by accepting and confirming the validity of the license. And an interesting thing is that it directly said, well, the GPL is like general business conditions. So it made directly a link between GPL and contracts, first things. So I'm insisting on that because I know there are a lot of lawyers coming from a common law country, and there is this big discussion about whether the GPL is a contract or not. First reaction of the German court, well, it's like general business conditions, it's like a contract. Then the court started assessing the different clauses that were used in that case and on which the authors relied upon in order to ask stop order. So I'm not going to go into details on that part, but I will just say that the German court had quite some difficulties to apply GPL 2, Article 4, sentences 2 and 3. But anyway, it made a shortcut and it said, well, I don't know if it's valid or not, but anyways, Article 4, sentence 1 is valid. Anyway, the famous Article 2, B is valid. So if the defendant tries to say, well, one clause is valid and the other is not, maybe the whole license is invalid. And if the whole license is not valid, then in any cases, you made a copyright infringement. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's quite clear. If you made a copyright infringement, I, as a judge, can order you to stop doing what you've done. So it granted the claim, and it pronounced a preliminary it a preliminary injunction, and in that case, actually, it was a judge confirming a preliminary injunction that was pronounced by another court. So it's a little bit of mix of two procedures here. But anyway, I think the conclusion is that GPL violation is a copyright infringement, and Sitecom was enjoined under penalty from distributing, copying, making available without complying with the license. And that's another thing that is quite important, I think, in that case. The court specially specified you have to stop and you have to pay if you make an infringement once again, if you distribute, copy, or make available without complying with the license. So it made a link between the two. You have to stop if you do not respect the license. And until that point, you cannot use the software anymore. But implicitly, it also says, well, once you respect the license, you can go back again. At least that's how I analyze it from a Belgian lawyer point of view, analyzing a German case. So I put some reservations about that, but that's also an interesting point where right now we are talking about reinstatement once a license has been breached. What are the powers of a licensor? And I think that's the reason why the conclusion of the court in that case could be interesting as well, specifically in Europe. Okay, another case where in German as well, in Germany, and I will not spend time on it because it's quite similar and there is no particularities there, so we can go directly to another case. Always the same person, so basically Mr. Welte, another hardware producer. Well, the canvas is more or less the same, so the hardware producer used a part of Linux in his firmware and did not comply with the GPL. The particularity of the case is that actually the owners, the licensors, and the hardware producers reached a settlement, and the hardware producer said, well, okay, I will comply with the GPL, but I refuse to pay you anything. I refuse to reimburse the costs of the of anything that you have done in order to reach compliance with the GPL. So basically, the author spent some money. They hired a lawyer just to make understand the producer, the hardware producer, that he has to comply, and so some disbursement has been made, and the infringer didn't want to pay anything back to the authors. So the licensors, the authors, decided to go to court in order to get back this money that has been spent on in order to enforce the GPL, and the court confirmed that not complying with the GPL was a violation of copyrights. It confirmed that nothing was invalid in the GPL, but it's quite vague. And well, there was also an antitrust plea from the defendant, and it was rejected as well. So basically, the court condemned D-Link, the hardware producer, to reimburse the lawyer's fee and the enforcement costs, and a little bit more, to disclose data about the suppliers and the customers of the hardware producer. And that's very interesting, because that's a step further. And when I say that it's a step further, usually you can ask that to a judge, and you ask that to a judge in order to prepare a second step, which means now that I know how many units you've sold, I can calculate my damages, and the indemnities that you have to pay me because you infringed my copyright. So I think it's very important to see that it's one step further, and maybe in preparation of a claim for indemnities. Okay, another case that I will not talk about, and the last German case. Well, it's not about compliance. It's about once again a hardware producer having some firmware, and the problem was that this hardware producer didn't want the users or another company to create another firmware and to install it on its machine. So it's a bit like the Tyvo case in the US, but it's not a Tyvo case, because in this case, the hardware producer was not trying to stop and forbid anybody to reinstall firmware with technical measures. That was a Tyvo case. But here, it was on basis of flow. They were just saying, well, basically it's my work. Well, maybe there is some GPL code there, but anyway, the result is my work, and then on basis of copyright, I can forbid anybody to reinstall my hardware. Another thing was that basically, when you analyze a little bit further the facts, AVM was the producer of the terminals, of the hardware. Cybits was the company that was actually offering a service and a program that could download the firmware, add some piece on it, and basically it was a firmware for some terminals, and the addition of Cybits was to add a parental control on the system and then reinstall on the machine. And the problem was that the code of Cybits was creating some shortcuts or whatever, and the results was not perfectly perfect, and there were some malfunctions. So basically AVM was saying, well, you are modifying my code, you are installing it on the hardware that I produced, and then the hardware doesn't work correctly because you modified the code, and that creates also damage for me because it's a trademark breach. You didn't erase a trademark, so I could be liable for the things and the mess that you are doing with the code that I put on my hardware. But basically, okay, that was the second argument. And there was also an antitrust or unfair competition side that I will not talk about it. And at the end of the day, the court said that, okay, the software on Fritzbox, maybe it's a collective work, but anyway, all the GPL parts are under the GPL license, and people should be able to modify it and to reinstall it. So that was a victory for the developer, the GPL code developers. And then about the malfunctions, well, the court said yes, well, there is a little problem there, because indeed you are still using the trademark, and then indeed the software is not functioning correctly, so please stop doing that. So this version of the software could not be used. But anyway, if you do it properly, there is no problem, and all the GPL parts must be open in that way that it could be modified and reinstalled on the hardware. Very interesting case. Well, it's not that much about compliance, but anyway, it's also very interesting. Now, about the French cases, as I do not have much time left, it's going to be very, very difficult to present these cases. What can I say? Just going to the teaching of the decisions. Anyway, I've tried to summarize it in a clear way, in order to, you know, somebody reading the slides should normally understand more or less what's happening. First case, Mandraksoft, it's quite old, from 2003. Basically, it involves some open source licenses, but the teaching is somebody used a GPL and released some documents under a GPL without having the copyright to do so. So the teaching of the decision is, please, if you want to release something under a GPL or an open source license or an open content license, be sure that you have the copyrights on it. Second case, how can I summarize it very quickly? Basically, it was somebody, a public company, so some kind of a university, wanting to transfer a software that it developed to a commercial company, and the commercial company wanted to make a commercial version of the software. And once the commercial company received the software, it realized that there was some GPL code in it. And it said, well, basically, I cannot use it in a proprietary way. I cannot exploit it. So there is a big problem. And the authors of the software said, well, the GPL part was not part of the deal. It was something else. So that part was called Jetlight. So it's not part of the transfer. Our software runs with Jetlight, but anyway, it's substitutable, so please recode if you want to make a proprietary version of the software. So they were not happy at all. They sued the copyright owners, and they sued for what? For dolus, so fraudulent concealment. So they claimed that they were never aware of that fact. And alternatively, they sued for breach of contract. And at the end of the day, the tribunal said, well, the acquirer, so the buyer, knew that there was some open source code there, GPL code there, so there was no dolus, and basically everybody made some mistakes, and maybe the seller underestimated the cost of recoding the GPL part. So basically the tribunal sent everybody home without any kind of indemnities, nothing, and that's it. Teaching importance and clarity and transparency as regards the nature of the code. This is a stupid case. it's really messy, but it's there is no teaching. And here, what can we say? Well, basically, a public administration procured for some program, a contractor. Was contracted for a job and then had to deliver some software, and then in the administrative procedure there was a check. At one point they wanted to check how far went the works, and they wanted to check the version of the software before the final delivery of the software. And they realized that the contractor erased the copyright notices. It replaced the copyright notices with his own copyright notices. And basically, the contractor said, well, it's not the final version, so what's the problem? What's the big deal here? And the administration said, well, we are not happy with that, so we want to terminate the contract. It went before court, and the court confirmed that indeed, there was a breach of contract, and erasing the notices was not a great idea. Open content licenses. First case, very interesting, but only for open content and music. I will not talk about it. Second case, Adam Curry. So in two sentences, Adam Curry had copyrights on his family photos. He published the photos on Flickr under a Creative Commons license, non-commercial. A tabloid reused these pictures in a nasty article on Adam Curry. He wasn't happy, so he sued, and he reached an injunction order. So basically the court said, yes, indeed, you have to stop using this non-commercial material. A problem, it was a specific procedure, only to have an injunctive relief, so a cease and desist procedure. And the court went a little bit further than what was asked, and it said the value of the picture is minimal, given that the pics are already freely available on the internet. This is very dangerous. It's not because something is under an open license that it's worth nothing. So that was really dangerous, and the judge didn't have to go that far. And I was not happy at all to read that in a decision. And that's what's leading me to the last case, a Belgian case, which is Lidschot Mapua against Théâtre de Spa. What was the case? A Belgian band, small band, published and released its music under a non-commercial license, Creative Commons. A theater reused the music in an advertisement. And the band said, well, you are using a license that is supposed to be non-commercial, but
using it in a commercial way, so there is a problem. And the band sued the theater, and on two bases, breach of contract and copyright infringement, and it claimed an indemnity of 10,000 euros. You breached my copyrights, you didn't respect the license, so I want some money in order to indemnify. Court's findings, so the attribution feature was not respected, the non-commercial feature was not respected, the non-derivative clause was not respected, nothing was respected, and it granted 1,500 euros per infringement, so a total of 4,500 euros for the use of a music that was under a non-commercial license. It was used something like 2-3 months in order to advertise the place that would and the representations that would have been presented or organized in the theater. So that was not bad at all, actually. And so that's the only slide where I put a red box pay, because that's the first time, I think, that we made pay somebody just because it infringed the copyright on a work that was released under an open content license. So conclusions very fast. I think that the validity of the license is not an issue. Getting an injunctive relief, normally it's no problem. No active copyleft enforcement as such, so there is no case about what is a derivative work, etc. And as regards indemnification, it's much more tricky. So some judges are saying, well, it's free and available to everybody, so it's worth nothing. Another case in Belgium says, well, not. It's under an open source license. It's available to everybody, but anyway, if there is a copyright infringement, we can grant some damages and indemnities in money for the damages done. Here you are.
Merci, Philippe.
Thank you very much.
So, I thought that was actually quite a good overview of European case law, and it was it's worth noting that there's a lot more official case law in Europe than there is in the United States.
Well, and is it the case that European courts share case law across countries at all, or like look to each other to find out what's going on with given case law?
Boy, I don't know what they do. I actually took an EU law class school, but it was so long ago, I don't remember. But I assume that they must from time to time, the way that in the United States, the different circuits and different jurisdictions look to each other and say, you know, how did this other court? It's not necessarily going to make up their mind of how they'll definitely decide, but it's one of the factors that they consider. So, and I think it's interesting
here in the U.S., they never look outside the U.S. That's the weird thing.
Well, but in the U.S., you asked me about within the European Union, and there,
right.
You know.
Well, no, but
so
I was just sort of thinking,
if they're interpreting, you know, EU law, they surely look to each other. I don't know. But in the U.S., we definitely look to each other's states. And sometimes we look to other countries, too. It's not necessarily, you know, it doesn't happen a lot. And there have been criticisms recently of the U.S. legal system that we don't look abroad the way that we should. And that we actually are a lot worse off as a, you know, as a legal system because of it.
But just given the way people are in the United States and the way judges are, I would think that it'd be very unlikely that any judge would want to look outside the U.S.
I think actually that probably there are cases where, or I would, I bet there are plenty of times when judges look to decisions in other countries just to see how the decision came down, even if they're not actually mentioned. Mm-hmm. In the actual decision.
Well, one of the similarities when he talked about the remedies that people have sought in European courts, they're basically the same, and the fact that the remedy of getting a derivative work or requiring a derivative work to be released hasn't been sought in actual court action. Now, obviously that's sought in settlement negotiations as part of a way if you release the derivative work properly. And I think that's actually true in Europe as well, that's asked for as well. But the actual court remedies are the typical ones we end up asking for in the United States, which are
like injunction, yeah,
and
which is probably
damages.
The most powerful tool that we have in our arsenal now.
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think the financial damages issue is more important because most people seem not to care that they might get an injunction against them because violators just continue to violate willingly. But the thing I really liked that Philippe said was that he said we should strengthen enforcement. So yeah, that's good to hear other people saying that because
the thing is that an injunction can really shut down a company's business. So if you can get an injunction, then, you know, whether they were willfully violating or not before, when you have a court order, it becomes a different thing. That's like, for listeners who were fans of LimeWire, you know, when the LimeWire site went down, that was as a product of injunction.
Well, although, I had a good meeting with Harold Valta recently, which I felt a lot better that Philippe couldn't necessarily pronounce Harold's name because I can often not pronounce names properly in Europe, that when they're just in Europe and I should be able to pronounce them. But the fact that two Europeans have trouble pronouncing each other's names is...
Well, they're very different language traditions, so true. You can't really expect... But it does make me feel better that we're, you know, as we butcher Philippe Laurent's name, that you know, he may have trouble pronouncing somebody else's name.
But anyway, Harold's told me that it's actually relatively straightforward and easy to get an injunction in Germany and quick. It's not so quick in the United States. You have to file
right.
a case, and then you have to file a preliminary injunction motion, and it can be a long time before you're in front of a judge actually arguing the motion, even though it's an injunction supposed to be for a quick remedy, but the courts move slower in the United States than apparently in Germany, at least from what Harold tells me.
Yeah, and I think it probably varies among, you know, with that throughout Europe, but I don't know.
Yeah, there was one case in there that I didn't know about at all. I didn't know that Mandrake had been involved in a lawsuit. It was over the FDL of all things, well, GPL as well, but I was really surprised that there had been a court case that actually discussed the FDL.
There were a few cases in there that actually I was unaware of, so I thought that was really cool. That was one thing I was really happy about this talk. I think there may actually be one or two other cases that he didn't include, but you know, he probably was for time.
He was constrained on time, and he raised the same issue that everybody else raised, and I presume next year we'll try and make changes, assuming that we're all going to do this thing again. But the other thing I wanted to bring up that he did say that a case that I think is a really important GPL enforcement case that Loic talked about later in the day, which for our listeners' point of view was they already heard it, was the AFPA case, the EDU4 dispute regarding the VNC software, which was a contract dispute, and so it was different than most GPL enforcement cases because it was over the fact that the contractor didn't do what they were supposed to do. But what they had done was they had basically ripped off VNC and bid on a contract that they could fulfill easily because they were going to infringe this GPL'd work, basically. And the fact that it came down to being just a contract ruling, it was still valuable because it was the GPL was the issue. And if they had ruled that, oh no, the GPL didn't mean anything, therefore what they did was fine, that would have been really bad. And the fact that they said, well, you didn't comply with the GPL, therefore you committed fraud in your contractual obligations.
Yeah, but thing. I think Philippe was probably saying a couple of things. One is, I think he was saying that the decision was a little confused. And so you're talking about the one where he said this is a stupid...
Yeah, well, I was troubled that he said it was a stupid case. Because I've heard other folks, for example, I know that FSF Europe thought that it was a completely meaningless thing. They didn't even cover it in their own blogs when FSF France succeeded in that. And I feel like that was a big victory, and FSF itself worked on it.
I think this like contract versus a license issue is really a big deal. And because of these remedies that we're talking about before, because you have so much less available to you when you're talking about remedies under contract law as opposed to remedies under copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we hear this talked about a lot. I think it actually is quite a big deal.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that case was a big deal. And I wish that more people in Europe paid attention to it. And I think some of it was partly politics, that it was done by FSF and FSF France and was not a case that was in the normal line. I think there was some politics there as far as the amount the community paid attention to it. I don't think Philippe is in the center of that. I think Philippe's primarily approaching this from an academic point of view, and isn't really involved in either of those sides in that case or any other case.
Well, cases. He did talk about it.
But he's studying it in the sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the other thing that I thought was interesting was this issue of the same thing that happened in the early courts in the U.S. on the Model Train case, where there were actually judges talking about this idea that if you release something under a free as in freedom license, the work must have no value. And this idea that these pictures didn't have any value because they were already out there. So why should an injunction be granted? That was really disturbing to me. And I was agreeing with Philippe that it was disturbing that the court even went there.
I think it's a natural reaction. And I think it's a natural reaction that people have when they start to understand what free and open content is. And, I think we're gonna see a lot, more of it in the short term and a lot less of it in the long term as people understand the value of freely licensed works.
I'm much more pessimistic. I don't think people are learning what this is, and I think the initial reactions continue to be unfriendly to it because people are drilled in their minds in schools that in law schools, for example, drill into these students' heads that it's intellectual property. I had the intellectual property argument with a number of people who you would think would be more supportive of free software just recently.
I think that's starting to change. I mean, when I guest lecture that class at Columbia Law School, and that's a class about the arts, but I talk a little bit about software because free culture law comes from free software law. It's been very interesting, and actually there's been a huge change in the last few years. Like, even just 3 years ago, if I asked at the beginning of the class who had heard of Creative Commons, who had read the licenses, who had heard of free software, who had heard of GNU Linux, and who had heard of copyleft. And, 3 years ago, almost no one had heard of anything. And now, the most recent class that I taught, everybody had heard of Creative Commons, and some had heard of copyleft. And it was fascinating. And I think that that's really starting to change because young people are incorporating a lot of remix culture, into their everyday and are expecting to be sharing more. And it's just part of the culture. And so I'm kind of interested to see what happens because I think that as these judges start to have clerks who understand, younger lawyers who understand these issues, that we might start to see a shift.
Well, we'll see the shift to, I mean, those are these people, these remix people are CC by NC types. They're anti-free software types.
Well, don't generalize.
Pro-Apple types.
Don't generalize. Although it's funny that I did go to this Brooklyn Law School panel. I wasn't speaking on the panel, but I wound up being quoted in one of the articles about it afterwards because I was sort of asking, you people are, so I didn't say that, but all the panelists were using Apple products and other lockdown services to make their points about remix culture, which was just counterintuitive to me. It was crazy. So I share
your frustration. It's counterintuitive to people like you and me. To people like them, they say, oh, free software, how quaint.
Well, they just,
you cute little free software.
So.
They've rewritten the history. Free culture came first. Free software is some stupid thing.
No, I don't think so. I think they just don't understand the issues and they don't understand how it really impacts them. And how they're making choices that make a big difference. And we have to do a better job at articulating it.
Okay. Well, we've had this debate before. So I think we'll leave it with that and let our listeners enjoy another talk from FOSDEM.
Cool. Free and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Free and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Free and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Free and Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us. Start over.